This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Colin Firth is now co-starring in the film Love Actually, along with Hugh Grant, Liam Neeson, Emma Thompson, and a host of other celebrities. Firth plays a writer who goes to the south of France to escape his failed marriage and work on his next book. He ends up falling in love with his Portuguese maid there. In this scene, he's trying to overcome the language barrier between them.
Romance?
Yes, it's,
policial, crime?
Yes, crime, murder.
Mete medo.
Scary? Yes, sometimes scary, and sometimes not. Mainly scary how bad the writing is.
Love Actually marks the directorial debut of Richard Curtis, who also wrote the screenplay. Curtis's other writing credits include Notting Hill, Four Weddings and a Funeral, and Bridget Jones' Diary, which also starred Firth. Author Helen Fielding wanted him for the part. In her novel, which the film is based on, Bridget develops a crush on Firth as she watches him star in the BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. Firth's character in Bridget Jones, Mark Darcy, is an homage to his portrayal of Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice. Firth's other films include The English Patient, Shakespeare in Love, The Importance of Being Earnest, Circle of Friends, and the upcoming Girl with a Pearl Earring. Terry spoke with him in 2001. Let's start with a scene from Bridget Jones' Diary. Here, Bridget has overheard Mark Darcy making sarcastic comments about her, and she's not happy about it.
I mean, you seem to go out of your way to try to make me feel like a complete idiot every time I see you. And you really needn't bother. I already feel like an idiot most of the time anyway. With or without a fireman's pole.
Look, I'm sorry if I've been...
What?
I don't think you're an idiot at all. I mean, there are elements of the ridiculous about you. Your mother's pretty interesting. And you really are an appallingly bad public speaker. And you tend to let whatever's in your head come out of your mouth without much consideration of the consequences. I realized that when I met you at the turkey curry buffet that I was unforgivably rude and wearing a reindeer jumper that my mother had given me the day before. But the thing is, what I'm trying to say very inarticulately is that, in fact, perhaps, despite appearances, I like you very much.
Apart from the smoking and the drinking and the vulgar mother and the verbal diarrhea.
No, I like you very much, just as you are.
Colin Firth, welcome to Fresh Air. In a lot of your earlier interviews, you talk about how you really wanted to put Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice behind you. So what was your reaction when Helen Fielding asked you to play a part that was an homage to your portrayal of Darcy in Pride and Prejudice, thus continuing continuing the whole thing?
I suppose I did it in the spirit of if you can't beat them, join them. I wasn't strenuously trying to put it behind me. I think this creation, the impression has been created to some extent, and you know, I found that the Darcy tag didn't really touch me unless I was speaking to a journalist. So it really wasn't something that was disturbing me. If there was any curse on it at all, I felt somehow instinctively that doing this other thing called Mr. Darcy, I don't know, there was some bizarre negative psychology attached to it. But I felt it might take that curse off. And in fact, it's been very interesting seeing my name being used, my actual name being used in articles now rather than the Darcy name. So I think at the moment, to some extent, it seems to have worked.
What was your reaction when The Diary of Bridget Jones was published, knowing that the character in the book had a crush on you?
Well, that's you can't not be enormously flattered to start with, you know, to have made it into fiction, into popular fiction, feels like quite an achievement. In fact, it's one of the biggest accolades I think modern society can accord you, is that you have now become, you know, part of the general canon of popular reference points, and it was delightful. It didn't happen suddenly, because this thing had been growing as a diary column for some time. But I was absolutely thrilled. I felt immortalized.
No, Pride and Prejudice is set in an earlier century. Your language and attire are more formal. I'm going to ask you to compare your acting style in each film, like a literary adaptation versus a contemporary comedy. But first, let's hear a scene from Pride and Prejudice. And in this scene, you first confess your love to the character of Elizabeth Bennet, played by Jennifer Ely.
In vain I have struggled. It will not do. My feelings will not be repressed. You must allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you. In declaring myself thus, I am fully aware that I will be going expressly against the wishes of my family, my friends, and I hardly need add my own better judgment. The relative situation of our families is such that any alliance between us must be regarded as a highly reprehensible connection. Indeed, as a rational man, I cannot but regard it as such myself, but it cannot be helped. Almost from the earliest moments of our acquaintance, I have come to feel for you a passionate admiration and regard, which, despite all my struggles, has overcome every rational objection, and I beg you most fervently to relieve my suffering and consent to be my wife.
In such cases as these, I believe the established mode is to express a sense of obligation. But I cannot. I have never desired your good opinion, and you have certainly bestowed it most unwillingly. I'm sorry to cause pain to anyone, but it was most unconsciously done, and I hope will be of short duration.
Let me ask you to compare your approach to contemporary romantic comedy, Bridget Jones, and dramatic literary adaptation, Pride and Prejudice. You can talk about your physical carriage, your accent, the speed you speak at. I mean, the speech is so much more formal in Pride and Prejudice.
It is. I think one just somehow instinctively adapts to the requirements. You can't say, can I have a light in a formal Victorian way. You can't say, allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you very easily in a kind of Bronx accent or a Cockney accent of the year 2001. So I think as an actor, it's essential that you're sensitive to language, and I think that the language actually informs the rest of it. I think that I certainly find that this is my starting point. My walk can change because of the way I speak, and then the way I speak will be informed by the rhythms on the page. So it's a process which happens, I think, without much calculation. The Bridget Jones Pride and Prejudice case is quite a singular one, I think, because Mark Darcy is, in fact, very much a fugitive, I think, from another century. I mean, I think this is part of his problem. Mr. Darcy is very much a man of his time. He's isolated by other factors, but Mark Darcy, I think, is not typical. He's not certainly not a typical of the Englishman of his age that I know. And I think that he comes from a rather archaic family, and I think that he's someone whose personality is crippling him in some way.
I'm wondering how the clothes affect you. Like in Pride and Prejudice, you're wearing frilled high-collared shirts, and in Bridget Jones, in the first scene that you appear in, your mother just gave you a really silly sweater with a large moose head on it.
And yeah. They affect you enormously. I had a bit more of a challenge with Mark Darcy, because I had to put on a ridiculous sweater with a moose head on it and pretend that I was standing in a frilly shirt and a frock coat. So I couldn't allow that costume to dictate the way I was holding myself. I had to play against the clothes in that case, and that therein lay the comic gag.
Just a question about your most famous scene from Pride and Prejudice. It's the famous pond scene. At the end of the story, you take off your jacket, and with your shirt and pants on, you dive into a pond. And although it sounds pretty inhibited to dive in with shirt and pants, for your character, it's a sign of feeling more liberated and expressive. When you walk out of the pond with your wet clothes clinging to you, you became a heartthrob. Did you understand that?
Not really. It it was so, that happened as a series of haphazard decisions. I mean, it was almost an accident, really, that led to the whole wet shirt business. And I think probably if anyone had connived at a phenomenon like that, they would have failed miserably. If I remember the original script, it had it down that Darcy dives in completely naked. And I suppose he might well have done that. He's on his own property and it's a hot day. But the BBC didn't consider that acceptable. And then there was some talk of underwear. And then we heard that nobody wore underwear in those days. And I think there was an attempt to create underwear. They're kind of, if they had worn underwear, would they have looked like this? And I went to be fitted with those, and there was no way on earth. And I can tell you now, had I worn those, there would have been no heartthrob.
What was this underwear looking like?
They were kind of knee breeched. I think they were cotton or silk. They looked like sailors pants or something from, you know, pirate. I can't remember very well, but they came down just below the knee. And
little pantaloony kind of things?
Yeah, not flattering.
Uh-huh.
And so in the end I thought, well, what's second most spontaneous to taking all your clothes off and diving into a pond? I suppose really not taking any of them off, really. You know, maybe just jump in. And which is basically how I tried to play it. It's the jacket comes off and the vest comes off while he just sort of sits there and thinks for a minute, and then in he goes. You know, no way does anybody think that is going to start to, you know, that's going to become a famously remembered image.
Did it affect your career in a positive way?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's so hard to quantify these things. I think it must have done. I think that everything you do, I suppose, takes you in one direction or another, and I can't see that it would have been negative. I do, I suppose I have an inclination, I've always, as an actor, had an inclination towards playing unhappy people, people who might be considered society's losers, and people who are unattractive. I tend to find that work as an actor far more interesting. And playing Mr. Darcy kind of took me a little bit further away from that. And I think there was a slight misreading of what kind of actor I was as a result of that. I think there was a feeling that this meant that perhaps I really was a romantic leading man, when I'm not, actually. I'm a character actor. And I think that's been confused because of this fairly neutral appearance that I have. But it was interpreted as a leading man performance, and it wasn't. Mr. Darcy was absolutely a piece of character work.
In two of your romantic comedies, you were in fight scenes. In Shakespeare in Love, you're the man Gwyneth Paltrow is supposed to marry but doesn't want to, and you'll duel with the man she's really in love with. In Bridget Jones, you have a fist fight with Hugh Grant, who's your romantic rival for Bridget's affections. What's the difference, do you think, between fighting in a comedy and fighting in a drama?
Usually, comedy is considered, in some ways, a more difficult form. It's considered the more serious form. Drama, you have to be disciplined for it. You put all your intensity behind it. You think, you know, kill. You think whatever. I think these things maybe things you have to work for and are not that easily attained, but they're certainly not that complicated. I think with comedy they are, because you've got to find an absurdity somewhere in it without looking as if you're trying to be funny. I think that the minute any comic actor looks as if they're asking for a laugh, they won't get one. I think that Hugh and I both had a very strong natural sense of the absurd. I think it was hopefully our own self-mockery that produced that fight. We didn't work very hard on it. We just thought, how would we fight? It's embarrassing to admit it, but that's probably exactly how Hugh Grant and I would fight if it came to that.
Colin Firth speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of Terry's conversation with him after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview Terry Gross recorded in 2001 with actor Colin Firth. His film credits include Four Weddings and a Funeral, Shakespeare in Love, and Bridget Jones' Diary. He co-stars in the new film Love Actually.
Let me ask you about your coming of age. I know your parents were both academics. Were they college teachers?
Yes.
And your grandparents were missionaries in India, I believe?
That's right, yeah.
What denomination were they?
Well, I think that changed through the years. My mother's parents were both Congregationalist ministers. That's my grandmother as well. She was ordained in the 1930s, when it was not that conventional in any church. And my father's father, in the end, was an Anglican minister. All three of them, I should say, belonged to the Church of South India for a while. My maternal grandfather rebelled against the Church of South India over certain things, and I think that's when he went Congregationalist. He became a doctor, in fact. I think he went out there as a church missionary. This is my maternal grandfather, and at the age of 38, he decided that he would be of better use in that country as a doctor. So he decided to get a medical training. The only country in the world that would train a man of that age was the United States. So he took his family to the United States and went through medical school in Iowa for 7 years, and then went back to India and set up practice there in osteopathic medicine.
Did your parents practice religion, and did you grow up in a religious household?
Yes, I think the word religion was always treated with a little bit of caution in my household. The short answer is definitely yes. My mother's interest has always been very much in alternative, comparative religions. She's very pantheistic. She has a lot of mystical interests, and the subject of her fairly recent PhD was death and bereavement in a Gujarati community in Southampton, for which she learnt Hindi. But she takes an enormous interest in a large variety of religions and tends to see merit in all of them. My father he keeps it much more close to his chest. I think it's something very personal to him.
So one more thing about religion. When you were growing up, did you find this kind of cross-cultural exposure to religion interesting or too kooky for you?
No, I found it fascinating. I mean, it was there from the start. It was never kooky to me. In fact, I found it much more difficult to adapt, I think, to a school environment where I was listening to prejudices against those sorts of things. My first 4 years of my life were in Nigeria. Not that one remembers a lot about the first 4 years of one's life, but it did make an impression on me, not least because people we'd known there continued to be in our lives as visitors, and there were constantly people from India. Both my parents were born and raised in India, and so there was an immense cultural diversity under my own roof throughout my entire upbringing, and I consider that to be absolutely nothing but a privilege. And so, and it to me, I suppose it was the norm. And so I found any kind of racist remarks or any kind of religious prejudices among my own peers very, very difficult to take.
What brought your parents to Nigeria?
My father was teaching. It was just curiosity. He took an overseas teaching post in his job as a history teacher in what would be the equivalent of a high school.
And where else did you live when you were growing up?
Well, mostly around England after that. We came back and we travelled around the English provinces. Well, my father took a job in another school, a high school level, for 3 or 4 years, and then in a college. And so that led to a couple, 2 or 3 moves, I think. And then we were a year in the United States, in St. Louis. I was in junior high. And then back to England. And so most of my upbringing has taken place in England.
Junior high is a tough time to change environments because I think most junior high school students have so many hormones raging out of control that they don't know what they're doing and often do really inappropriate things. And it's a tough period. Was it a tough time for you?
I've been bumped up a year because the English start school a year earlier than the Americans. We go into first grade, the equivalent of first grade, when Americans go into kindergarten. So the reasoning was that I should be put in a class of kids a year older than me. And there was a bit of a shock attached to that because I was an elementary, you know, what we call a primary school boy. And I found the kids around me at this high school much, much more sophisticated. So it was a difficult adjustment to make. I have to say, though, that some of the teaching I had that year is the best teaching I've ever had. I still remember very clearly my English teacher, my history teacher, my science teacher. And I sometimes look back over my school years and wonder if I really learned anything at all. But I do look over that year, and despite the fact that it was a mixed experience, it's one of the only years I can single out as having specifically remembered what I learned.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with actor Colin Firth. He's now co-starring in the film Love Actually. He also co-starred in Bridget Jones' Diary, Shakespeare in Love, The English Patient, and What a Girl Wants. Firth also writes fiction. One of his stories was included in a collection edited by the British writer Nick Hornby, whose novel High Fidelity was adapted into a film. Firth starred in the adaptation of Hornby's earlier novel, Fever Pitch. He played Paul, an English teacher and high school soccer coach who is obsessed with soccer, or football as it's known in England. For the first time in 18 years, his team, Arsenal, has a chance to win the Football League championship, but it's falling behind. In this scene, Paul's girlfriend, Sarah, played by Ruth Gemmell, has come to tell him he didn't get a promotion at the school where they both teach, but Paul is depressed about the game.
Do you understand what today meant to me? Do you know how long I've been waiting for this?
Yes, I do, actually. 18 years.
Yeah, 18 years! 18 years! I wanted Arsenal to win the league longer than I wanted to do anything. And after that stupid little end-of-year job for about 2 weeks, do you honestly think I'd care about that more?
No, of course not. No, I know that you care more about whether one team scores more than another team at a football match. You really thought I came here to comfort you about that?
Did for a moment, yeah. Credited you with some imagination. I honestly thought you might understand how I was feeling.
Paul, it's only a game.
Don't say that! Please! That is the worst, most stupid thing anyone could say. But it quite clearly isn't only a game. I mean, if it was, do you honestly think I'd care this much? Eh? 18 years! 18 years! Do you know what you wanted 18 years ago? Or 10? Or 5? Do you want to be head of year at a North London comprehensive? I doubt it. I doubt if you'd wanted anything for that long. And if you had, and if you'd spent 3 months thinking that finally, you were going to get it, and just when you think it's there, it's taken away from you. I mean, I don't care what it is, a car, a job, an Oscar, a baby. Then you'd understand how I was feeling tonight. But there isn't, and you don't, so.
You have a short story that is in a collection of short stories edited by Nick Hornby, who's best known for writing High Fidelity, and there was a movie adaptation that was made of that not long ago. You also starred in the movie adaptation of Fever Pitch, his story about someone who's just obsessed with soccer, or football, as it's called in England. I'd like you to read an excerpt of this story for us. And how old is the character in the story?
He's 11.
And his grandmother is sick and is kind of losing her sense of orientation, and that's in large part what the story is about, his reaction to seeing this going on around him and watching his parents' reaction to his grandmother's death. Would you read this excerpt for us?
When I got home the next day, Mum and Dad were arguing about Grandma. Mum was saying that the old lady would exhaust us into the grave and outlive us all. I couldn't hear what Dad said. Grandma's room was getting really stinky now. It had always been a bit stinky, but this was more toilety now. It hadn't been irksome before, but it was now. When I went in, she suddenly sat up in bed and said, "Where am I?" I said, "You're here in your room, Grandma." And then she grabbed my arm and she said, "I'm over there. I'm over there." And she pointed to her photo on the wall, of her as a young girl, Emma, in other words. And I said, "Yes, that's right, that's you." And then she pointed to her dressing gown on the back of the door and said, "There, that's me, there I am." And her hand got tighter on me, which hurt. Then she started saying my name over and over again, like, "Henry, Henry, Henry," like that. "Henry, Henry, Henry." And I told her she was hurting me, but she was shouting really loudly now, and she started saying nutty things like, "Put my voice under a walnut tree, Henry, Henry, Henry." That's when Mum came rushing in, already all red and worked up, going, "Henry, what have you done?" Then I got free and ran to the door. It's funny, because then Mum's face changed, and she went over and hugged Grandma quietly and calmed her down. She rocked her like she was 2 years old. When I came out, I saw Dad had been standing at his door listening. He shut it when he saw me. Later, in my room, Mum did this speech where she had this patient, wise voice that she always uses for talking bollocks, where it's like, "When you're older, you'll understand that this is not bollocks." She said that Grandma needed me to let go of her. Like I had to say goodbye, and it would be like permission for her to go. I said I could see what she was up to, and that Mum and Dad and Max and everyone might want her dead, but I wasn't going to help her with her conspiracy.
Colin Firth, what inspired this story?
Don't know. I find it very, very difficult to answer any questions about this. I don't know. It just made it up, came out of my head. There must be a better answer to this. It's a very odd thing. My own grandmother died about 2 months ago, and it was, you know, to some extent, it was life imitating art rather than the other way around. A story has meant a great deal to me from the beginning.
In this character, your grandmother's a storyteller and tells her stories all the time, though it's much difficult for her to do it toward the end of her life.
Well, I found that interesting too. I think that, you know, I'm interested in the idea that, you know, that one can have this passion for stories, and the grandmother, I feel, is, she calls herself his muse at a certain point, because he listens to her stories, and then he recounts these stories to his schoolmates and earns a certain amount of popularity for that. And I feel that wherever one draws inspiration, that is not necessarily going to be an inexhaustible spring. I think that you've often got to go and look for it somewhere else. And I think that when the voice of your muse gets scrambled, what happens then? And I was interested in that, because I would often find, I thought I'd found an answer here. I'd continually through my life, I've solved a problem, and then you find that no, you can't continue using that resolution. You've got to go and find it somewhere else. And so I found that the whole business of language and of the loss of the use of clarity of language was very interesting. And I think that the other element was the relationship between the very old and the very young. And I think that it's something that's hugely important. Our society probably doesn't make quite enough of it. We put old people in homes. I think we're rather afraid of seeing what happens to them. I think we have a very, very big taboo in Western society about death. I think it's a taboo that's arguably bigger than sex was to the Victorians.
In the story, the boy has a dream just before his grandmother dies that her dentures are talking. Her dentures, not in her mouth, are talking. And I know several people who've had death dreams or death premonitions that had to do with teeth.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Now, that's interesting, because this really was just some wacky thing I made up. So I'd never heard that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're telling me that this has actually come up as a bit of a as a syndrome.
Well, it kind of rang true to me, I'll say that.
How interesting. I wonder what that is. I don't know whether... I mean, teeth are... I don't know. I would hate to even try to analyze.
All right. So you didn't have a grandmother who was dying when you were young?
No. No, I'm in the extremely fortunate position of having had all four grandparents alive still at the age when I was 34. So they've all gone now. But I hadn't experienced any death at all in my family until 34. So one can carry a strange, irrational feeling inside oneself that nobody ever dies in one's family. Of course, you know, intellectually you're waiting for it, and you can see people getting older. But until you actually feel it, there's a sense of immortality. And so it was, it was the most enormous blessing in my life that I had these people around me for so long. I had, there have been people of my age, friends, who have died for various reasons. And that experience goes back to childhood. A very close friend of mine died on a motorcycle when we were both teenagers. It's been kind of topsy-turvy. I've lost people who are young, but not so many people who are old.
What kind of beliefs about death were you brought up with? You know, we talked earlier about your parents and grandparents. Your grandparents, you had a couple of grandparents who were missionaries. Mm-hmm. Your mother, you described as being more pantheistic, and she wrote a mm-hmm. dissertation recently about religion. And you were exposed to many different religions when you were growing up. What did your parents tell you about death?
Well, I think that what I suppose the views that I'm trying to expound probably originated there. My father doesn't usually express philosophy very much in that area. He allows doubts to be doubts, and I think I would go along with that, really. I don't think I feel very certain about anything from a philosophical point of view. My mother has very strong interest in concepts of the afterlife. Again, I don't think she has a fixed view, but she has actually done research into the whole business of, clinical death, the death that takes place on the operating table where people come back again, where she's interviewed a lot of people and she's actually published stuff on that. And I have grown up with an awareness of concepts that death is a transition, that it leads to something else, that it's I remember being captivated as a child by the idea of the analogy of the caterpillar coming out of the cocoon and becoming a butterfly, and finding out that the ancient Greek word for butterfly was psyche, and that, you know, that somehow it could be a release. And I do love that idea. As I said, I have no certainty. This is not built into a belief or a belief system or
an ideology or anything.
No, not really. But I do find those issues quite fascinating. I don't necessarily know that the most important view of death is about that and how glorious an afterlife might be. But I think that it's the one great inevitability we all face, and I think that facing it can only be a good thing.
Well, one more thing, and we only have about a minute left. Do you write a lot? Was this story unusual, or have you been writing?
Writing's been a hobby of mine for years. I enjoy it. As I said, I love storytelling. I read and I like to write and think things up. I've never had a huge ambition to be published, so it has remained a kind of hobby. I sometimes exchange stories with friends. I have a couple of friends who also write a little bit, and it's often been just to just to appeal to somebody's sense of humor as much as anything else. But yes, I do.
And Nick Hornby knew that you wrote?
Yes. He was encouraging me to do it. He wanted me to, for quite some time, actually. He'd been just giving me a little nudge every so often in the belief that I could come up with something worth publishing. So I owe him a great debt, actually, for making me finally...